Hey, Dr. B.
Hey, Luke.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm good.
Yeah, because I feel like whenever you say I'm good, I'm okay, there's actually a lot of stuff going on. What's up?
Yeah, there is kind of a lot of stuff going on, you know? I feel pretty overwhelmed with work and trying to start a
We all go through junk, but we don't have to go through it alone. If you sometimes get overwhelmed by life or work or relationships or anything really, maybe you just need to talk to somebody. Check out Modern Therapy, a psychology practice here in Houston driven by one overarching mission, to cultivate a well-lived existence despite life's inherent challenges. Check out mymoderntherapy.com to make an appointment with Dr. Beatrice Craven or one of her associates, or give them a call at 281-783-9297 and tell them Luke sent you. Again, that's mymoderntherapy.com. From Milieu Media Group, this is The H, a podcast about the people and places that make Houston, Houston. I'm your host, Luke Bronner, and this is Season 2, Episode 3, Nick Panzarella, Pawn Artist. In the year 2000, when I was 20 years old, 1 year after dropping out of college on little more than a whim, I packed a bag and moved to Cap-Haitien, Haiti, where I spent about 15 months living right in the center of an orphanage a few blocks away from a beach that makes Galveston look like a Hawaiian island. I moved there completely alone, at a time when cell phones and internet access were incredibly difficult to find. In fact, even regular mail was hard to come by. 2 days a week, I'd walk about a mile or so from the orphanage to the airport, where I'd sit outside, sometimes for hours at a time, talking to local kids and waiting for an airline from West Palm Beach, Florida to deliver mail on the hopes of hearing some word from home. Those long conversations with those Haitian kids were instrumental for me in two ways. First, they helped me learn Haitian Creole, a language I love speaking to this day. Secondly, they lit in me a passion for languages that sixth grade French, high school Spanish, and college Greek had failed miserably to light. For nearly two decades now, I've been casually obsessed with the study of languages, how they came to be, how they evolve, and how they connect to one another. I find it all so fascinating, but I've never really had any friends with whom I could nerd out over language studies, at least not until recently, when I met Houston native Nick Panzarella.
I'm Nick Panzarella. I'm the owner and CEO of Wild South Tea, a local tea company producing cassina here in Houston, Texas.
What is cassina?
So cassina is the product made from the leaves of the yaupon holly plant. And so it's a caffeinated beverage, really similar to green tea and yerba mate. And so, yeah, it's like a wild-crafted tea that's native to East Texas and then the Deep South.
Nick grew up as the second of four boys in a family with deep Italian and Louisiana French roots in Kingwood.
It was a master plan community, and so like they wanted to bring the forest into the suburb. So spent a lot of time riding bikes, going through the woods. Always kind of annoyed that there was no real public spaces, and I think any Houstonian kind of recognizes that issue. There's no like squares or no places that you can just walk to. In Kingwood, it's even worse than downtown Houston because it's just so spread out. So spent a lot of time like just trying to be in public. There's a place called Town Center, which is kind of like any master planned town center, like the Woodlands or something. And I'd like constantly try to spend time with my friends like in that area because it was the only part of Kingwood that really felt like a community sort of.
His longing for community has manifested itself in several different ways throughout his life, as has his love for the outdoors, although that took a little longer to develop.
I was also a Boy Scout throughout my entire middle school and high school career. So we spent a lot of time camping, learning about, I guess, like woodcraft, things like tying knots or like identifying trees and things like that. But Boy Scouts, like anything, is really what you make of it.
And frankly, for the first several years, Nick didn't make much of it.
My dad was an Eagle Scout, and so were his two brothers. And so he was one of three boys and one girl. He had four sons, so he wanted to beat his mother in producing Eagle Scouts. So it was just like a requirement. I mean, we did it. We didn't really care about it. Sometimes we had fun when we were camping with friends. And then what really changed it for me is there's this thing called High Adventure. There was three original, now there's four High Adventure camps. And so one of them is like you sail through the Keys of Key West. You spend 5 days out there. It's awesome. It's incredible. You get to pick your trip. You could say, We just want to go to make sure we get to Key West and we get back. So if we can sail there, that's great. But if the winds aren't great, we're going to use our engine as much as we can to get to Key West. And like, that's the point. We're spending a night there and then we're coming back. Or you could say, I just want to sail. I don't care where we end up, but we're sailing for 5 days. And so, you know, those kids are going to learn more sailing than what we did. But there's another one out in West Texas called Buffalo Trails, where you could spend 5 days on horseback going through the mountains. Philmont is like the Mecca for Boy Scouts. And that's a mountain up in northeast New Mexico. And you're just hiking. And it's this huge camp. And it's so big. And some people fall in love with it. And so they found camp guides, people who worked for the camp, who got fired or quit and still are like on the trails, just like living in the camp. And so that's a really cool place to hike through. And there's another one in Canada where you're doing canoes and stuff. They call it portaging. You're picking up your canoe, going over islands and different lakes. But so basically going through those, it's not just a weekend. You can't just go without planning. Like, those are really serious trips. And doing that kind of stuff with Boy Scouts made Boy Scouts like a really kind of like immersive experience, where you had to learn some of these skills and you kind of came away with it a little bit different from, I guess, like everyone else you were at high school with. Like, you just spent, I don't know, 2 weeks out in like the Canadian wilderness and like you feel like you've learned something. And I think that's where I kind of started learning, like, okay, you'd see other Boy Scouts who knew stuff. Like, they would know tricks like, oh, your shoe doesn't fit, like slip your belt in the back. And like, it works as like a, what do you call it, a shoehorn. I asked a kid, I was like, oh, did they teach you that like for a merit badge? And he's like, no, just like, we're Boy Scouts. Like, always be prepared is the saying. And so no one's going to teach you these things. You have to go out and learn these things. And so as I got older, basically when I was almost out of Boy Scouts, I realized that there was all this awesome information out there that I could learn, but that I totally missed when I was in middle school and early high school. And so at the end, I started like trying to learn how to tie as many knots as I could and like identifying different trees. And like, there's a weird kind of connection between Native American culture and Boy Scouts, for good or for bad, but trying to like learn as much as I could about local Native Americans, which was really tough to find, especially back when like the internet was not as fleshed out as it is today.
One of the most important and useful lessons that Nick learned near the end of his time in the Boy Scouts was how to lead other people well.
Everyone has to do a project, your Eagle Scout project. And mine was, there was like some benches at the elementary school that I'd gone to that were falling apart. It was like a little plaza kind of area. And so we removed the top of like 8 benches and then had to reconstruct the bench tops and then attach them. And then just because we were there, one of the dads in the troop brought a power washer and we power washed the concrete. But the cool thing about doing an Eagle Scout project is you have to first design the project. So it has to actually be written out. Then you bring it before a council and then they can approve it or deny it. And then after that, you have to have volunteers. So you have to have an actual work day where you are the leader and you have to tell people what to do. And the plan is supposed to be so developed that the plan will happen. Like, they say, what happens if you break your leg the day of? And so the plan has to be functional enough that it all happens with the volunteers, with or without you being present. It's like a huge exercise for someone in high school to have to become like a leader, basically, and like manage a team doing whatever it is you're doing.
What was that experience like for you?
A little stressful. And I had friends that had told me, like, they knew that I would have a project. And like, when you're going to do this project, let me know. I felt like really embarrassed to ask people out because it was kind of like mixing two parts of my life, too, Boy Scouts and like my friends, but then having to tell people what to do. And like, once again, I was in Boy Scouts, but I knew almost like zero about construction and like tools and stuff. So it was like a little nerve wracking, I guess, to have to do that. But really cool to see that if you have a good project and you have a plan, I mean, this was Boy Scouts too, so there was this built-in network of parents that were there to help you, that people show up and that people, if you have a problem or a question, like there's someone there that can answer it. And also like the wood that we needed, someone in the troop just donated probably $100 worth of wood. So it was never even an issue of getting supplies and never an issue really of getting volunteers either. So it was stressful, but I guess maybe a little heartwarming and like just easy at the end because there were so many good people there to work together with.
His time in Scouts ended when he graduated from high school in 2009. But the lessons he learned have continued to be beneficial.
It taught me at a young age kind of how bureaucracy works in a weird way. I mean, for Boy Scouts, it's, you know, you don't achieve a certain rank until you've met the requirements. And whether that's getting a merit badge or you have to have a one-on-one conversation with the scoutmaster. So basically, like, there's someone who's designated to like talk with you and make sure, like, have you understood the requirements? Have you learned the lessons that are necessary for this rank? And then you move up to the next rank, having to do, yeah, the Eagle Project, compiling the plan and everything, accomplishing that. I think it taught me a lot of how bureaucracy works. And that translates into applying to college and then graduating from college. That applies to just getting your license. I mean, and I think just teaching you the patience of knocking off one requirement after another. And so those kind of skills, it's no matter what you want to do in your life, if you can look at it as like, this is a one step at a time process, learn the rules so that you can function within the system to accomplish the goals you want. And there's a point in it where they say, if you think there's something wrong with the system, you know, you basically are morally obligated to change it, but you should do it through the system. And to me, you know, when you're in high school and you're learning about American civics, it just seemed like so quintessentially American and hopeful that they're telling you like that there is a way to change the system in a correct manner, and that we all should be looking for ways to change the system, but that we should be doing it through the right way and through like the right paths.
The ability he acquired in Boy Scouts to walk with patient persistence through the tasks required to accomplish a specific goal have been particularly useful over the past few years.
I recently reacquired Italian citizenship, and that was like a three-year project of like working with, you know, two different governments and filing paperwork. Technically, me and my family were born Italian citizens, according to Italian law. None of us really knew that. But so I started reading about other people that had gotten Italian citizenship. Basically, Italy works, unlike America, it's called juris sanguis, and so it's the law of the blood, whereas we're juris solis, which is the law of the land. So if you have Italian blood, you can reacquire your Italian citizenship if you meet certain guidelines. But if you can prove that one of your ancestors was an Italian citizen, not just born in Italy, but was an Italian citizen, and you can get the birth, death, marriage, all the certificates, you can collect all those, the naturalization paper for when they became an American citizen, you get copies of that, you get them translated, you get it stamped by the Texas state government, then you can send that to the town where your family came from in Italy. You don't have to take a test on Italian civics or learn Italian. They just give you your new birth certificate that says you're an Italian and an American citizen.
Nick embarked on this journey not only for himself, but also on behalf of his entire immediate family.
I spent like a year or two collecting all the documents, and eventually I sent in the application. We got an appointment, and then all my family is now Italian because of the work I did.
What was the drive behind that?
So my grandfather was born in Italy. Never met him. He died in 1969. My grandmother was from Chicago, 100% Italian, spoke Italian in the Genovese dialect. She really didn't seem to care too much about her background. I think she wanted to be American more than anything else. But my dad was like really focused on the fact that we're Italian. And we use certain Sicilian words at home, not much, but like it was really important about we're Italian. And then I think even too, for me, more so than my brothers, I look more Italian than my brothers do. I have darker curly hair, darker skin. And so for me, I felt just very Italian. I felt I was looked different, I was different, and I thought maybe being Italian was part of that. And so that kind of like led me to start learning Italian in ninth grade of high school, just on my own in books. And then we would visit our cousins in Sicily. But being over there in Sicily, like it's such a definite culture. And like they act a certain way, like they touch you a certain way, like the way they eat and drink, and like just everything about it was like mesmerizing to me.
His family is from a small town in the province of Palermo in southern Italy called Monte Maggiore Belsito. But not everyone in his family feels the same draw to their Sicilian roots.
Our family left Sicily because of some criminal activity. And so my grandmother, who's not Sicilian, was like, I don't want you to talk with that side of the family. And so in the 80s, my dad took a trip to Sicily and he just went to Palermo and opened up a phone book and looked up the word name Panzarella and then called the first one. It was a first name that looked familiar. And he called and he was like, oh yeah, we're related. And so my dad went out there and he was supposed to stay there for one night. He was supposed to go to Greece the next day. And he ended up spending 2 weeks with them. Like he just said, there's something about it. Like when he was there, he said it felt like home. And I think whenever I visit Italy, Sicily, like it does feel like there's some kind of connection. On top of that, if you're a European citizen, if you're an Italian citizen, you're a European citizen. So you have rights within the entire EU. You can go to school, you can live, buy property, work without any encumbrances. And so for me, after studying abroad there, I was like, this seems like a cool option. I would love to be able to live in Italy in the future. Yeah, it was something that I knew I wanted to do and at least have for my kids too.
We'll come back to the part about him studying abroad. But first, I had to ask about the criminal activity that led his family away from Sicily.
So what we had heard was one of our cousins had sold a blind mule to someone who was involved in the mafia. So the guy was mad, so he killed our cousin because like he'd been basically cheated out of a deal. And so our great-grandfather, in retribution, killed this mobster. And then there was a big sit-down. The whole town agreed to prevent a feud or a mafia war or something, that my great-grandfather had to leave the country. And so he moved to Chicago and was a butcher. And they opened up, I think, an Italian grocery or something.
So that's one version of the story. But it's not the only version that Nick's been told.
So what we've been told when we went back was that our great-grandfather was like an aspiring gangster and had like a growing mob family that was competing with this other family. And so the other family had hired an assassin to murder him. And that our great-grandfather gets word of this and murders the assassin in the street. And then he gets booted out of the country. But goes back and forth, we find out, too. There's ship records that he's going back and forth, brings his family over. And then we've heard stories that he pretended to have, like, a mental disorder in America, so that maybe he's, like, laying low. And then we've heard that they sent two assassins to America that no one ever heard from again. And then that, like, we've inherited, like, multiple guns that have these, like, weird stories. It's like, this one belonged to, like, a department store Santa. Like, this one was a cop's gun. That's all we hear. Like, there's no story to it. It's like, how did you get a cop's gun? Did you buy it? Like, that makes sense, but, like, what happened to the assassins? Did they move to America? I was like, this is amazing. Like, I'm just going to set roots down here. And so, I don't know. It's like a really complicated, kind of strange story. But, you know, I hear it's not even uncommon for these kind of things to happen with Sicilian families.
While that may be true, thankfully, Nick grew up far from mafia assassins and Sicilian mob drama. After graduating from Kingwood High School, he made his way to New Orleans to study at Tulane University.
I was looking for places that had an interesting linguistic department, and they actually have a really strong Central American studies program. So they offer a couple of different native languages like Mayan and Aztec, which is Nahuatl. I wasn't even going to apply, but then I saw they had this Mayan program and I said, you know what, like I'm interested in doing that. So I applied and got in with a small scholarship. So I said, okay, let's go. I'd been to New Orleans once or twice before and I really liked the city. And on my mom's side, like my grandmother was born in Louisiana, she's Cajun French. And so I felt some ties to Louisiana. I'd studied French in high school and so I really wanted to kind of learn Louisiana French while my grandmother was still alive.
While he loved New Orleans and the opportunity to connect with another piece of his heritage, his overall experience at Tulane was less than perfect.
Tulane is a very northeastern school in a weird way. It's a lot of people from New York, New Jersey. I don't know, I had like a big chip on my shoulder when I went there. I just felt out of place and kind of like weird because I was from the South. And like people weren't trying to be rude, but they would like say things that like kind of rubbed me the wrong way. Like, oh, New Orleans isn't Southern because, like, people aren't racist here, which is, like, one wrong because there are racists. But it was, like, so the only, thing that makes it Southern is if they're, like, bad people to you. Like, that's, I don't know, it rubbed me the wrong way. But the city was amazing. The campus is gorgeous, and it's super easy to just meet people. It's a small school. It's about almost the size of my high school.
Nick is the first to admit that some of the problem with his Tulane experience was his own failure to step outside the university bubble and really embrace what Louisiana had to offer.
Learning Louisiana Creole or like even things that are kind of touristy, but I didn't look into, I wish I'd done at the time. Like just recently, I was looking into Louisiana voodoo, and in my mind, I thought that voodoo was like, I knew it existed. Everyone knows it's like a historical fact, but I assumed that there was no one who practices it now. And there's still a lot, like there's this thriving voodoo culture there. And like, that's something that I'm interested in. And I wish I'd at least just delved into and met some people and maybe met some more French speaking people on my own. I did get to participate in a Cajun and Creole study that we did. So I studied linguistics. So I kind of made my focus minority and endangered languages. And so there was this project where we went out into places where they still speak French, mostly around Lafayette, and looked for Cajun French and Creole French speakers, where you kind of realize like there's all these different layers of like, because Cajun French is really just Louisiana French and like people would classify it, but if you're white or black, but then like it gets so much more complicated because we'd find white Creole speakers who learned it because, I don't know, they spend a lot of time with black people or because that's just what their family spoke, or people who think they speak Cajun, but they speak Creole, or black people who speak Cajun French. But I was just impressed to see how many people still speak it. And we were with some French people on the class. So we'd go out there, we'd spend a night out by Brobridge or places like St. Martinsville and just record people speaking.
So how many languages do you speak?
I'd say fluently Spanish, Italian, and English. And then enough to like watch TV shows and like get by as a tourist, French and Portuguese. And those are all super related. And then I'd add Sicilian and German and then a little bit of Polish.
But Nick's passion for learning languages was and is fueled by far more than simple fascination or the desire to watch TV in other countries.
I want to save dying languages. That's what I would tell people. Or like, I want to work with Native American languages. I think what I realized is that there are very few jobs for someone wanting to do that, especially someone with just an undergrad degree. I didn't like school because I didn't like being in a system where you're like stuck for a long period of time doing like one thing and like following the rules, and I just didn't like it. So I didn't want to go get a master's or a doctorate, which is where the real fun stuff I think happens. Maybe what put me off at the end, I worked on the Tunica Project with Tulane. So the Tunica Biloxi Tribe of Louisiana, they're in Marksville. They've got a casino. The last native speaker of Tunica died, I think, in the 30s. They have a dictionary. They have a lot of information, linguistic information. So they want to revive the language, bring it back to life. And so I worked on the program, working with them, and it was just, it's so tough because if it's a non-Indo-European language, it's going to be so hard for English speakers to learn. And if there's no native speakers currently, it's three times as hard. And so as a young kid trying to like work with this project, it just like it stressed me out so much that I was like, I don't want to do this kind of work. Like, this is miserable. So I think for me, either doing it as like a volunteer thing is a good way to do it. Maybe there's some way to do it profitably in the future. There are a couple of startups working with language stuff, but I think it's just underfunded and it's hard to find a good job with it.
While he hasn't exactly found a professional home for his passion and gift for languages, he has found a worthwhile use for it.
I'm a volunteer with a group called WikiTongues. And so I'd seen a friend of mine from Tulane. He was at Tulane for one semester and he like posts on Facebook, "Hey, my buddy works for this, or he runs a nonprofit called WikiTongues. And WikiTongues is working to document every language on the planet in video." So they're trying to get like just a lot of information. So basically like a language that is dying out, let's say if there's a lot of information online, people can use a language, they can listen to it and they can share it. But then if, you know, in the chance that the language dies out, we have more information. We have people that are actually speaking it, not just texts and things like that. And it's okay, 7,000 languages, it's pretty hard to document. Even just to get the names of them in a book is tough. But with the internet now, if you live in Italy or if you live in South Africa, and you just hear about us, you can film on your phone, post the stuff on YouTube, and like, boom, we've got tons of people all over the planet recording these languages. So I got involved basically as an excuse just to reach out to people who speak cool languages. And then now I manage the volunteers across the country. But my main focus has been with the Alabama Coushatta people of the Livingston area to get a glimpse into the worldview of someone who's like, I mean, they're not from here originally. They've moved here from Alabama 300 years ago. But like they live indigenous Southeast Texas. It's actually two different tribes. They've always been linked just traditionally. They like live close to each other. But Sam Houston gave them a piece of property back in the day in East Texas. And so they kind of like set up shop there. And they've been together so long that they're like one unit. They still speak both languages, Alabama and Coushatta. They're really closely related. They're not mutually intelligible, I think. It'd be like Spanish and Italian. Like you can tell they're related, but you can't understand each other. I think it's awesome that someone speaks a native language fluently really close to Houston. So I wanted a way to reach out to them. And so with WikiTongues, I was able to reach out. We established a partnership and soon we'll be recording their language. But they're aware that unless they do something now, they're probably going to lose it in the next 50 to 100 years. And that's true for probably every indigenous language, which is terrifying. So WikiTongues is cool because you can work with tribes like that that need real hands-on like work. The language, just recording it isn't going to change things. But there's tons of people who are doing great things to like preserve these languages, and it gives me an excuse to reach out. But it's really cool just like crowdsourcing linguistic information, trying to preserve things.
But Nick's connection to this small tribe in East Texas isn't limited to just the language they speak.
The Alabama Coushatta drank Cascina, and they drank, ritually drank it, and they used, I mean, all the products that are around here, they use that in their lifestyle.
In addition to his love for language, Nick had also discovered a pretty serious interest in locally sourced food while studying abroad in Bologna, Italy, when he was in college.
After college, I moved back home. I was really interested in the slow food movement, healthy food, local food, indigenous food. So when I graduated, I came to Houston and I started working at Revival Market. Well, I actually started working with Urban Harvest first. They do the farmers markets. So I was teaching gardening. Then I moved over to Revival and I was a catering manager. I wanted to be at Revival because I thought I wanted to open up a grocery store because they would be like, I could have all the native and local stuff that I wanted. Realize it's not exactly what I want to do. But after working there for a year, I went on to work with Edible Earth Resources, which is now called Loam Agronomics or Agmenities. They have several different companies, but I was basically a PR community liaison for this edible landscaping company. So I just wanted to do stuff with food. Then I eventually started bartending, worked at a couple different bars, got trained at Cultivare, which is also owned by the people at Revival.
So Nick spent the next 2 years working, saving money, and making plans to move to Italy. He'd already begun the process of pursuing Italian citizenship and thought it might be more feasible if he lived there. He wasn't sure how long he'd stay or exactly what he'd do when he got there. He just knew that's where he was headed.
During this whole time, I'm thinking about Yaupon. Because to me, it's a native product. No one's doing it. I'm thinking, like, I want to maybe do something with this. So Yaupon is the plant that we make Cassina from. And it's this native plant. So I guess to connect a couple of things, Yaupon was the first plant I was able to identify in Boy Scouts. It's very common. In Kingwood on the Greenbelts, it's everywhere. 80% of the plants you see are Yaupon. It's this green bush. And I'd always heard that Native Americans would use it to vomit. And so what they would do is they'd create this thing called black drink. So they'd brew the Yaupon leaves. They'd make, so we say processed Yaupon leaves or Cassina. So they would take this Cassina, they'd boil it and create these giant like black vats of Cassina, the black drink. And they would like chug it, like almost boiling hot. Scientists now say that that's, the hotter the product is, the more caffeine your body can absorb. So they've got this like extremely caffeinated, strong substance, ingest it, they get the buzz, and then they ritually purge themselves. Because the caffeine is this like psychoactive ingredient, it is like a purifying agent. And then they would ritually vomit and then eject the black drink. And so European settlers that would come with, like, sit with them, the missionaries, would like be in a group. They just drank it with everyone, and they would watch everyone start to vomit around them. And they'd be like, oh no, like, when's it going to happen to me? And they would never vomit. And so the missionaries kind of like learned that the Cassina doesn't make you vomit, but the Native Americans use it in a ritual vomiting ceremony. And so the scientific name of the Yaupon plant is Ilex vomitoria. And there's theories that someone from the East India Trading Company chose that name so that Cassina wouldn't compete with China tea. So you'd be like, oh, it's that vomit stuff. Like, let's not use it.
Well, that would have been plenty to keep me from ever trying it out. It didn't deter Nick at all.
So, okay, when I'm working at Revival, I'm experimenting with Cassina, I'm roasting my own, I'm like letting people try samples. And then, you know, I take this idea, whatever, and they go to travel for a year, basically. I go to South America because they drink yerba mate there. Yerba mate is a genetic cousin of the Yaupon plant, Cassina, very similar properties. So I want to see, like, what's the culture like? Because I can look and I can talk to someone who could tell me how to make it. I have Argentine friends here. But like, I really want to see how they do it down there. So I go down to Mexico City, down to Buenos Aires, and then Brazil. Saw a little bit in Buenos Aires how they drink it, like they do the bombilla and everything. And like the mate is what they call the gourd. Basically, like my Airbnb host, she would like drink the mate as like a study. Like just like we would do coffee. Spent some time in Brazil, would ask some people there. I wasn't in the right part of Brazil where they drink it, and so I didn't really learn too much. And then I went to Palermo where I like sat down as like a base camp and would just kind of travel from there. While I was there, actually, in Brazil, I met a journalist who tied me in with someone from Vice News because I wanted to freelance write to, as a way to support myself. And so I like was writing for Vice when I was in Palermo for a little bit doing Italian politics, and then eventually just like, quit working. And I was like, I saved all this money. I just want to hang out and like eat pasta and seafood. And it was super cheap. I spent like $200 a month on a room, and like I got tied in with this study abroad group. So I had like a bunch of friends from all over Europe. But there I talked to a guy from Germany. I told him about my idea with the Cassina, and what he told me was that in Germany, they drink a soda called Club Mate. Club Mate is like it's a yerba mate soda. It's really popular with like gamers and stuff. And he's like, look, if this thing is popular in Germany, like there's no reason that your thing in Texas shouldn't be popular with people in Texas. And so at that point, like a week later, I basically bought a ticket home. After traveling for like 9 months, I came back to start the company.
The company is Wild South Tea, and starting it has been no easy undertaking.
First thing I did, I got graphic design done. Should not have done that right away. Should have waited a year, 2 years before I'd done that. But for me, I really wanted to look professional. And I think that's what, like, I kind of realized, like, why am I starting this company? And I think it was because, like, I wanted to feel like I owned a company instead of, like, actually producing something great. And so I got this, like, amazing logo and all this cool stuff done. But it was for, I think, the wrong company at the time. So back then we were called Panzerella Import Co., which is a ridiculous name. The idea was we were importing Cassina from like the exotic South, and everyone just thought it was like an olive oil company because of the name and the thing. So it was whatever. Also back then we were trying to sell like tea bags and loose leaf tea. And it was just tough and like figuring out what to do. I was working alone. I didn't want to get another job. I still had some money. So I was like just doing this thing. I was really depressed because I'd just been traveling, like basically just partying for like a year, meeting people from all over, walking everywhere, cooking for myself. And all of a sudden, I'm back home with my parents and Kingwood in the suburbs. There's like no one who's from like not America around, even though in Houston, there's, you know, a plethora of interesting exotic people, whatever. You know, it doesn't matter where people are from, but I was just bored and lonely and sad and just depressed. I'd be like, oh man, I worked so hard today. I'm just going to like lay down in my bed. And it's like, that's not being tired from work. That's like depression. I like had really low expectations for what I would do with the company. You know, we'll be selling the tea all over Houston, period. Like, that's all we want to do. And like, I wouldn't give myself the credit to think like bigger and like think like, well, this could be like, this should be nationally distributed and like, this can be a really cool big thing. And so took up a couple of side jobs, started bartending again. And finally, when I hired someone, a lot of people would tell me like, oh, use volunteers. And I would try to do that to save money. But if you don't have people who are committed to working with you, and like, you can't tell people to get up really early if they're not getting paid, you know? And if you're like, if I wasn't getting paid doing this thing for 2 years, like, it's just not sustainable. So when I finally got a full-time employee, that's when things really changed. And he kept pushing me to do a bottled beverage. So we started doing bottled, and then everything took off. Like, all of a sudden, we can get into stores. Before, we would deliver bags of this stuff to people. And so, like, I assumed that chefs would hear, like, oh, there's this new product. It's a new flavor. It's indigenous. It's got this long history. There's this weird exoticness to it. It's got caffeine. You know, it's, like, local caffeine. Like, that screams, like, this is trendy. And people would just be like, interesting. Like, cool story, period. Like, no, nothing, no, move forward, no, like, let me carry it, let me make a dessert with the flavor of it, let me make, like, a cocktail with it, no interest. It, like, boggled my mind. It, like, frustrated me, it made me feel like we were doing something terrible, like, there was no future for it. We would give people literally a pound of dry Cascina and, like, hear nothing back. And then I'd hear that, like, the staff at a restaurant is drinking it and that they're selling it as green tea, and it's like, oh, my gosh, like, you guys are, like, you're selling the product and you're not even, like, you're not talking about it. You're not even telling it what it is. Like, you could call it Native American tea if you wanted, but they're like missing this, like, I think an opportunity. So anyways, once we got it in a bottle, it speaks for itself. People could just think it's black tea. Like, they think it's Southern tea, and great, it sells. Like, if it's in a bottle, it's a done deal.
I've tasted several of their teas now, and he's right. As far as flavor goes, it does speak for itself. It's excellent. But as I'm not much of a connoisseur, besides being locally sourced, I had no idea what made it different from any other type of tea.
So black tea, green tea, white tea, and oolong tea are all made from the same plant. It's made from the Camellia sinensis. So notables about Camellia sinensis is that it has caffeine, but also something called L-theanine. L-theanine, they say, like, monks would drink it because it puts your brainwaves in alpha state, which is like a more creative, calm state of mind. What's interesting about Cascina, like yerba mate, it has caffeine, but also theobromine. Theobromine is a type of caffeine that has twice the half-life. So the way it affects you is that it's not as strong. Like, it's not going to give you, like, jitters like coffee might, but it gives you energy, and then it's steady, so it lasts longer. And so people talk about, like, it being able to focus you. It makes you feel good. Theobromine is related with, I think, serotonin, like happy, good feeling, things like that. Also, the taste, it has less tannins. Black tea can... We add sugar and milk to it sometimes. We don't add milk, I guess, here, but a lot of people add sugar because it has the tannins, which are drying, could be bitter. Cascina is not bitter, doesn't have those tannins, doesn't dry your mouth out. Super refreshing, super chuggable. It's just like, it's so easy to drink. Like, and the way we sweeten it too, if we do sweeten it just a little bit, so it kind of like makes you want to like just finish the whole bottle in like half a second.
While they may seem unrelated at first glance, Nick's love for Cascina and other locally sourced foods is actually rooted in the same place as his love for language.
I think you can kind of see it maybe in the way I think about languages is maybe culture in general. So there is a wealth of different cultures and different traditions within everything. And I see it with my Cajun family, with my Sicilian family, with just the general culture of Louisiana, with Native American people. There's these awesome things that we all do differently and anywhere. And even it just could be from New Orleans to Houston, the way we eat, the way we talk, the way we pray, the way we dress, there were differences. And then I think as the world becomes more globalized, for better or for worse, we lose a lot of those traditions. And I think it's a shame to lose a language, and it's a shame to lose part of our cultural heritage in the form of food. And so there are so many good things in our region that we are not using because the dominant culture came from somewhere else. Whether it's people that came from another part of the South, from the Northeast of the United States, or from England, or from Scotland, wherever our people came from, we're not using the stuff that's from here. And I wanted to sell a product like that, and I have vision for the future of a multitude of products that are local and delicious and awesome from here that would basically be like, I guess Texas already does have a really strong food culture, so you could say, like, what's the taste of Texas? And you could say, like, oh, there's barbecue and there's sweet tea, things like that. But I think there are things that could be even more unique. And I think when you go to a place like Italy or when you go to somewhere like South America, the distinctive things about the food culture are, like, part of who they are. So I think Cascina was, like, the low-hanging fruit. It's this delicious thing that has caffeine in it and was super important for people in the South. And not only that, there is a long history of all Americans of all races using it in the South at one point. And so it's like, if this thing is from here, has a long history, tastes good, and has caffeine in it, it's like, I don't understand why it's not being sold right now. And so my thought was, I need to race to be the first one to make this a national brand.
Before he could put Casino on the map in any significant way or build his tea empire into a nationally recognized brand, there was one crucial step he needed to take first. He had to learn how to make the tea.
I read a lot of different things about different beverages. I read about how do they make tea, right? Like if you Google it, the problem is most tea is made in India or China, maybe some in South America. Like there's no English videos. Like who are they going to be teaching? Like what's the point of that? And so looking on YouTube, reading books, I read like a book about China tea, just the history of tea, understanding like, okay, what are the different processes? What are the different machines that are used for it? And trying to see how we could rig our own versions of that, like cheap versions using small tools and things like that. There are recipes online for people, like some of these people never stopped drinking Casino. In the Carolinas, there are people like, oh, my grandma used to drink it, like this is how we did it. There are historical texts explaining how Native Americans, Spanish people, and American settlers drank it. So it's like, okay, let's take all that and let's see what tastes good.
So how many different recipes would you say you tried before you were like, oh, found it?
Maybe like 20. I wouldn't say it's like, you know, some people are like, oh, 100 different. I think, and that's everything from like the way we roast it, the way we chop it, the way we brew it, the temperature, the length of time, the amount. It took a while, but I think our product to the actual dried Casino that we roast, we hit some kind of sweet spot. And I don't think it was because of multiple attempts. I think we just got lucky. And I've tried some other people, you know, people who make it at home and stuff like that and other companies. It's just not that good. But this one, it's like, there's something about it. We hit the sweet spot.
His process for making Casino involves first harvesting yaupon, which grows wild on a piece of land his family owns, about 45 minutes northeast of Houston in New Caney. After harvesting, he and the folks who work for him take it back to a quaint little house in Humble that they've converted into a production facility. There, they roast the yaupon, dehydrate it, strip the leaves off the branches, and grind them. They then brew the ground yaupon in a rented commercial kitchen space in Houston and bottle it for distribution to stores and restaurants all over the city.
We started at the Urban Harvest Farmers Market. So there in the Kingwood Farmers Market, we started selling the loose leaf. And we knew, like, okay, in 1 month, we need to have bottles. And so we just did whatever we could. We found some bottles we could put stuff in, did it the right way. We made sure the label had all the legal requirements for a farmer's market. And so we started there. And then we started just knocking on doors. And Urban Eats was our first retail location. And Levi and Eric there are amazing. If you have a local product, like, they are the guys to go to because they will take a risk on anyone who wants to try to start something. And I've heard that from several other food entrepreneurs. So they put us on the shelf. That gave us confidence to ask other people. I mean, the bottle was like kind of weird. It looked like a barbecue sauce bottle. The label was sloppy. It was like too glossy and it like felt sticky when you touch it. But we started with them. We got added Good Dog. They're an amazing account too. We're working with local people. Fantastic restaurant. We're now at 23 locations. We're in Austin and Houston. But okay, so like you don't all of a sudden get that big. So we needed to have people cooking. So we had one production manager who was doing like almost all the cooking. And it was overwhelming because he's taking care of the leaves and like I'm going in there cooking too, but if I'm making sales, I can't produce. So we had another guy, Victor Gonzalez, who's now our production manager. He started helping out a little bit just for free, hanging out because he had nothing, he didn't have a job. So he's hanging out with us. So he becomes an employee. Our other production manager moves away. We add another cook. We start to take on part-time cooks. So we're not cooking that much, but we could have someone who like wants a couple bucks, so they'll work like half a day. And I think being young and having a lot of friends who are unemployed or living with their parents and don't need a bunch of money, I was very lucky to have people who wanted to work. And so that's how we kept growing. We kept adding accounts. And then, yeah, it's just knocking on doors. You know, it's calling people. It's sampling. But yeah, just making sales and then adding more employees and cooks as like the demand grows.
A lot has changed for Nick since his days as a Boy Scout growing up on the green belts in Kingwood. He's learned several languages, graduated high school and college, traveled the world, worked as a bartender, a gardener, a writer, and now started his own company. But one thing has been consistent since he was a kid. His deep appreciation for and desire to both participate in and preserve the cultural traditions of other people.
I kind of have this theory that a lot of problems with Houston can all be solved with urban design. But there's a bunch of people that are really concerned with how Houston develops. And I think a lot of us are like obsessed with this idea of like how parking destroys Houston and how it's this car-centric city makes it hard for us to actually interact as a community. And so it like diversity is a huge example. Is Houston is the most diverse city in the country, and yet you can easily miss a lot of that diversity. I mean, like, pick a country. Like, we have the largest number of Nigerians and Ghanaians outside of Nigeria and Ghana. But when you're all spread out and you only can drive to different places, there's no public squares that we can just bump into each other. You miss out on that diversity. And so for me, yeah, if I had like a dream, it would be for downtown and midtown and maybe even Montrose to become like this carless like place with little like piazzas or squares where like there are people who are walking to work and like bumping into each other, and that you could experience that multicultural city on a day-to-day basis, and that you don't have to drive to like, oh, like this is the like Hispanic part of town or this is the Black part of town, but it's like, no, we're all here and we're all living together. You know, where's the chance to mix it up? I think if there's like a direct benefit that I could tell someone like that they would get from being around diversity, this is a chance to find different solutions to the problems that everyone experiences. And you can maybe like see that there's like tidbits within like language or food, that there are these different like ways of seeing things. Like, okay, crawfish is a good example, right? So crawfish is huge down here, right? So we do it in like the southwestern Louisiana tradition, you know, big boiled crawfish, but multiple different cultures use crawfish, and Nigerians use crawfish powder to cook with. And so like being able to see something that we use and interact with on a day-to-day basis and seeing another use for it, we make our lives richer. Another kind of weird example was growing up in Houston, I didn't actually see that much cactus fruit, the tuna or the prickly pear, even though it is everywhere. And like, I don't know, I wasn't looking, and I guess people just didn't eat it regularly, see it more in margaritas. But in Sicily, so they've brought the Texas cactus over there, I think in like the 14 or 1500s, and it's like taken over Sicily. And so it's super common for Sicilians to eat prickly pear. Like, they eat it all the time. You just pick it up off the street and like cut one open and eat it. Unheard of to eat Nopalis or Nopalitos, the cactus pad. Like, I would tell Italians like, oh, do you know you could eat the pad of the cactus? And they would laugh, because it's like, well, who in their right mind would do that? Like, what's the point of that? And so I think when you have a lot of people from different cultures interacting, stuff that's so obvious to someone else is like nothing to another person. And I think maybe that's like part of like what I do with Wild South Tea. No Texan would have thought to make a beverage from Yopon, which is a trash plant. I mean, people burn it by the acre on their ranches. But someone either from the Carolinas or a Native American person would tell you, like, yes, this is like a really important plant with a lot of good benefits. And there's even, I've had Mexican American people reach out and say, my grandmother used this for healing purposes. And there was like rituals that they would use it for. And when you mix all these people together, you hear those stories. And forget food, like, you could apply that to engineering and to marketing and to, I don't know, to sales, to everything. So if there's a concrete benefit to diversity, let's just say it's, yeah, looking at things in a different light.
So I was curious. While Houston is undeniably an incredibly entrepreneur-friendly city, with his dual citizenship, his ability to communicate well in so many other languages, his appreciation for other cultures, and his love for travel, why, of all the places in the world where he could be successful, he chose to return and make Houston the home base for his company?
So when I was traveling, I spent a lot of time with locals wherever I went. Like, spent a lot of time like with people who were showing me things. And like, it was amazing when you were with a local and they like spoke the language. They like would bump into friends everywhere. And not only that, they had like a long history. Their family was from there and they had like stories about everything. And so in a lot of ways, I wanted to be a local again, and I wanted to be somewhere where I have roots on, you know, different sides of my family, and somewhere where I know people, and if I go to a store, I'm going to bump into someone. If I go anywhere within like maybe a 20-mile radius of Houston, there's a pretty high chance I'm going to bump into someone that I went to school with, went to church with, worked with, met at a meeting. And to me, there's huge value in that. We got a small investment recently, and we threw a house party, and we had a ton of people there. And it was just amazing to see like all the different people from like a lot of our different friends' lives be able to just pass through, and like people that we hadn't seen in years that just like, oh, I'm happy to be in town. I heard that like you guys were having a party, like people from high school that we knew for like middle school, people that we've known for like over a decade now. There was something special about being able to do something like that, just casually throw a house party and have, you know, 100 people that we've known for 10 years be around and not have to make it, you know, no one had to fly in, no one had to do anything special. It just happened on accident. And to me, that's something you can't pay for. You can't buy anywhere.
To be local.
to be local, that you can't buy being local.
The thing I love most about Nick's story is that he was able to look at the wild yaupon growing all around him, this plant that most folks see as a nuisance, a trash plant, whose only perceived function was in an ancient Native American purging ceremony, and see only the pure, raw, untapped potential for greatness. That is the culture of this city, a city in which outsiders struggle to see value and beauty. I used to be one of those people, as I'm sure many of you were as well. Before moving to Houston in 2009, I had no idea how amazing this city is, how rich in culture and diversity and history it is, how strong its people are, how full it is with pure, raw, untapped potential for greatness. What a gift it would be, even as a transplant, all these years later, like Houston native Nick Panzarella, just to be local. One of my favorite things to do from time to time on this show is to point you towards other folks in this city who are doing work that I believe is worth your time. Today I want to tell you about my friends Hafiz and Chris, who host a really fun show here in Houston called The Roommates Podcast. Here's how Hafiz describes their show.
So basically, our podcast is called The Roommates Podcast, and we like to say it's a late night conversation, taking our listeners behind the scenes of becoming an adult, featuring all the crazy and wild people, conversations, and perspective they experience on the way. Imagine those good old college days, right? When you guys were all hanging out in the dorm rooms, just having all types of crazy talk about past, present, and more than likely future. And then all of a sudden, people would come in the room, and you guys would be up late at night just talking about everything. That's basically what our podcast is. It's just a bunch of young adults just having these really dope conversations. And we say our brand of conversation is entertainingly educational enlightenment, which means it's like we're entertainment, like it's a sitcom, so it's funny, so I got some great laughs. But then it's also educational, like a TED Talk, so you learn a lot, you see the world differently. And then, like I said, it's enlightening, like a sermon, so we want to leave people uplifted and encouraged. And I think that's the dopest part about our podcast, is that people, you learn a lot, you laugh a lot, but more than anything, you leave changed and a better person at the end of the episode.
My favorite thing about these guys is their willingness to just be honest about where they are in the journey into adulthood. The show is fun, sometimes serious, sometimes ridiculous, usually both, but it's definitely worth checking out. You'll find a link to their show as well as all their social media profiles in the show notes for this episode. Huge thanks to them and to Nick Panzarella for being a part of this episode. And as always, sincere thanks to you for your continued support of this show. You're the very best, Houston. I'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 4. This episode of The H was produced and edited by me, Luke Bronner. Our artwork is by the talented folks at Spindletop Design in the Heights. Check them out at spindletopdesign.com. Our theme song is by Robbie C., and other music featured in this episode is by the ever-impressive Scott Benton and Cameron Pissera. This and every episode of The H is sponsored in part by Pink Cilantro, a social-first digital agency focused on marketing, branding, and making life easier for people like me. Check them out at pinkcilantro.com. Now here's a scene from episode 4.
It's just like bringing about a cultural change, right? To help people like feel comfortable in their own skin and to understand that there is a world of opportunity out there for them, even if they don't fit into these neat little boxes.